As retailers entered the lockdown in March 2020, a small, diverse group of Canadian thought leaders gathered to virtually speculate, collaborate, and share their insights on the waves of disruption facing retailers. The Business of Retail podcast emerged as an unflinching strategic alternative to the conventional discourse, revealing challenges in the headlines and exploring new, unconventional paths for all facets of the retail industry. Now, here's the panel.
Welcome, everyone. This is the Business of Retail podcast. Today's topic is going to be around data literacy and retailers. We've got a special guest. It's Brian Pearson. He's the former CEO of Loyalty One. And we've got, of course, our regular guest here today. We've got Gary Newbery, George Minakakis, Christine Cowan, and David Ian Gray.
Well, thanks, Craig. And maybe we'll start with a quick intro to Brian, because this is a perfect topic for Brian to join. The ongoing discussion, the data, we hear data all the time, data-driven, data-led. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding around that, and there's a lot of misuse of the term. So we're going to unpack that today. But Brian, as many of the listeners and viewers will know, is the longtime CEO of Air Miles, which kind of morphed and matured into Loyalty One, which became a pretty holistic analytics end-to-end company leader globally. And also, and Brian's also written on loyalty and data, and provided numerous thought pieces to Forbes. Brian, how about updating? What are you up to these days?
Well, retired from Loyalty One, which is great, but that's opened up opportunities for me to really focus on working with some companies that are doing very interesting things in and around the data space with the retail community. So whether it's AI in category management, or whether it's looking at employee information, frontline sentiment information, you know, there's a rich wealth of opportunities. And of course, David, I'm still involved a little bit in loyalty in one way or another. So can't get that out of me.
Well, let's, and you and I have spoken about this many a time over the years, where, you know, we sort of have this notion of the term, and it's like the word strategy. Everyone likes to use it as a term, and no one wants to say we're not data centric or data led. But how do you, maybe we'll open up to all of us, like, how do we even define what insights and data means in a retail environment? Is it just a throwaway term, or does it mean something much more specific, or somewhere in between?
Okay, if I can just chip straight in, I think that it'd be easy for us to say we're data literate if we're using things like comp stores and profit by per linear foot on shelf and all the, you know, sales per square foot and all that. We can say we're surrounded by data. And the interesting thing is, we often start using data that we've got. But that's not really data literate. That's just saying we're taking the lazy path through this, and we're naturally collecting sales. We'll analyze that, so we know all about sales. We're naturally collecting square foot and everything else. And it's just stuff that's so easy to collect. And then also we get a whole mountain of it, and we find it hard to process all this information. What really I would say data literacy is being able to pose the right questions of ourselves to get meaningful insights to inform what actions we should be taking, both next couple of months' time, next quarter, the year beyond that. So having that ability to really understand what we need and into go and find ways of collecting that data, because sometimes what we need is very difficult to collect, but we must stand the course, and we must drive for that, because it will give us effectively a competitive advantage in the marketplace. If we've got it, we acted on it, because it gave us some great insights as to what to do next.
It's funny, I see the use, the sophistication level of organizations around data and what breadth or narrow focus that is actually at a meta level its own indication of the maturity of retail and the maturity of the organization. Because when I started my career, it was around research and data for retail in the late 90s. And the sector didn't really need it. Like, most of my clients were banks and telcos. Retail just, it was the old stack 'em high, watch 'em fly. So why was there any need to really get robust information around customers or product movement when everyone knew how to do it? You just had to get on with it. And I think it's almost a lead indicator to say, hey, someone who's, or you could argue a lagging indicator to say, as the industry has become more competitive and more complex and is maturing, that's kind of then driving that need to figure out how they can drive value out of, call it insight, that's data driven. I don't know if others have seen that.
Well, you know what? I from on the retail side, I came from a world that was very data driven. The KP, you had on a Monday morning, you were looking at 65 KPIs, right? I think we used 10% of them in general, but I mean, the numbers were everywhere. You had all kinds of numbers, but the data sets were really important because we became very customer centric because of it. And we just didn't use the words. We actually executed that way. Every customer coming in was very, look, when you're selling eyewear, first of all, no two eyes are the same. Right. So when you get everybody wears glasses here, no, very few have their eyesight is equal on both eyes. Right. So you got every customer coming in, you have to have that data. You have to have past customer information. So when a customer comes in and you know who they are and what they bought from you before, you've already started a relationship in the past. You can pick it up from there. Right. All that information is very, very critical in driving that loyalty in that customer and that return customer. We learned to become very customer centric by using that data. Mind you, you know, that data became very outdated if you didn't tap into it. And I think, Brian, you're nodding your head because you agree with me, because after a couple of years or an event like this one, like COVID, it changes everything, yeah. Right? So there's this dynamic that happens that you've got to start refreshing and recollecting, but I'll leave it at that.
And I think you had the privilege of being in an industry where you needed to collect customer data because it was part of the service requirement. It's like the comment that was made about banking and insurance. I mean, in those instances, you have an established list. For me, what's been interesting, and I love the term that you raised, which is customer centricity. And in some ways, you can talk about data literate. I think the biggest violation is actually further down, which is the customer centricity issue that exists within most businesses. And, you know, despite being in loyalty for the better part of three decades and helping a lot of retailers that had no real visibility in who their customers were, aside from putting them in the room in a focus group or doing some market research, all of a sudden there's this transformation. And, you know, what's been fun to watch for me is we've just gone through a few decades of the greatest transformation in marketing that we've seen since marketing began, let's put it that way. And the complexity that companies have to deal with today and the amount of data that's coming at them today is creating a very interesting dynamic. And that dynamic is, yes, loyalty programs are generating customer insights and the ability to track behavior over time. That's very important, but there is this gap, this chasm that exists between collecting the data and then meaningfully utilizing it to shift the focus. So Gary's right. I mean, we had sales per square foot and all these sorts of Jim Roy and whatever. I can't remember all the terminology, but putting the customer into the middle of that and using that as a lens to kind of address your strategy and where things are going is for me where the largest gap was and still in many cases exists. The loyalty things come along, the programs are being executed better on a global basis. There's a big dialogue around that. But on the data side, you know, it's not percolated into the senior executive ranks in a way that would make sense for me.
Brian, you just did something for me with all the diversity, equity, inclusion stuff. I'm learning the concept of unconscious bias. And mine came from customer first. And you and George just reminded, we got to be pretty specific about what we're saying here, because a retailer could argue they've been very data centric, as to your point, when you focus on SKUs, inventory turns, capturing store sales every single day.
Supply chain.
Customer, I think if we all kind of agree on this, it does tend to be more on the customer end of things. What's the customer data that we're an insight we're driving? And I would agree with you. I think there's a long way to go.
Yeah. There's a big challenge, I think, in that, you know, David, you're talking about the old days, you'd have focus groups or whatever to connect to your consumer, and then a report comes out, and then you kind of drive business off that. And I've seen it in some of the companies I've worked for. You sort of get this insight around your consumer and you do all this work and you mine this information and then you come up with your strategy. Well, that consumer's moved on probably by the time you've done your research. And so there's this constant evolution and this old school way of sort of doing these big projects and then thinking you've got it all pulled together. Like, we need like the constant interaction with consumers on a day-to-day basis. And those brands that are now doing that and finding ways to connect meaningfully to their consumers and building relationships are the ones that seem to be having more success with it. Because, you know, you can mine as much information as you want, but there's also the timeliness of that information. And if you can't react to that information in a timely way and move forward and trust that you've thought through, you know, obviously you've got to think through all the financial implications, but there's this movement that is really important in many businesses, and you can't move forward with that if you don't have really robust consumer relationships and understanding around that on top of all your data integrity and information.
Yeah, you know what the challenges are, that you know you can say you're customer obsessed, but you can only be as customer obsessed as you're obsessed about your data, right? and it's true. There is no separation there between the two, and I've seen it all the time. Some of the better ones at it are the airlines. Definitely the airlines. You watch what they're doing, right? When I lived in China and traveled to Hong Kong, Dragon Airlines was amazing at using that data with past flyers, right? It was something extreme that you didn't get to see everywhere. And then you come back to North America after that. You know, when I came back in 2009, late 2009, you know, the whole world was all about the recession. And I'm trying to figure out, okay, what are we doing about driving traffic to the stores, right? What are we doing about driving, driving the experience? We were working on things, but people, when I noticed with other companies, they were just wrapped up on the issues and they weren't focused on the customer. And I remember working on a project after I left my corporate life. It was an acquisition, and we spoke to the CFO because we wanted to get access to the customer data. Brian, brace yourself. The CFO said, that's not necessary. You don't need that stuff, right? Why? Because they couldn't access it, right? It was so outdated, they couldn't access their data. And that's a shame, because that's what's happening. And I'm curious how many retailers and businesses that are consumer facing that just don't have the kind of level of data that they could capture so they can to maintain their business and continue to grow, even small ones.
George, I got to ask Brian a question, because Brian, I've shown you this before. I'm a four digit air miles card number.
Like, yes, early.
Yeah, very early. But I remember always wondering what Safeway in particular did with the data. Like, every time I was in, I'm given the number, and I never saw any outcome from that. And are you out of NDA? Like, can you share some stories about where things were captured but never used, or what would have been going on there? Or do you want to sit that one out?
No, I won't sit that out, but I think what's fair to say is, in the early days from an air mile standpoint, was in a lot of senses, a lot of our clients were really not focused on the customer. It's back to what George was saying. I think we provided a central point where we started to shed the light on, you know, the frequency of not what the sales were doing and what sales growth was, but exactly what was happening at the individual customer level. And so we were analyzing that fairly robustly, whether the clients were then taking that and acting on it in terms of offer structures and different opportunities. That's a different story altogether. But gradually over time, I would say that, the data was certainly influencing the offer constructs, trying to both acquire customers, which is always what the retailer wants to do, new customers, but recognizing the wealth in the business was retaining your best customers and making sure you treated them the right way. And then also looking for people who are already shopping, already had the experience. Maybe they were coming in once or twice a cycle or a month, but they weren't giving you all their business. And if you could get that one extra trip every 6 weeks, it has a material impact on your sales and profitability. And so, yeah, maybe David, you were just such a great customer. You were too early stage for the educated, educated set of my clients to be targeting in some way. But I think that's, you know, I would want to talk about one other trend, which I think is, for me, has been something I've been watching as you go forward. And that is the contrast between the retailers who fundamentally are offline, that they're physical, and what's happened over the last 10, 15 years with the online retailers who have come in, who are now realizing, wait a second, I'm not capturing all the spend, and they're coming offline. They're starting to set up bricks and mortar very strategically. And I remember writing an article saying that if you wanted to pick somebody who would be able to customize their assortment for their store in Soho, which they did open, or one up on the East Village or wherever it would be, it's Amazon. They've got all the data on what customers are actually. So if you want to pick, you know, the 1500 SKUs, which have to be in a clip in to track the customer to come in to do whatever else, yep, they've got the breadth of information to be able to do it. And they start with a view of customer first, because that's what they're managing to, right? And so I do believe, again, in terms of major waves of change that are sort of flowing through, I think this whole online e-commerce environment is driving an element of change, which is dramatic. And the pandemic is only going to accentuate that over the last little while, because many retailers have had to up their game dramatically on that side of things. And in the course of doing that, I think they're learning new skills, or they're, let's say, enhancing skills that are going to be critical to take to their core business.
Well, the digital guys are the ones who, you know, really invented the modeling around customer journeys. That was not retailers doing that, because you didn't need to.
Grow up. It was about how you navigated through the app or the e-commerce site or whatever it would be.
I remember going to the shop.org, which was the NRF spinoffs back in the early days of it, and all the fresh thinking around analytics and even KPIs and things like that were all coming out of the digital people, and they were very ghettoized. They were separated out from the main business, but we've seen over time things like conversion and other metrics start to creep their way into the overall business. But you must have had a really good window on that, because I think the other driver was loyalty programs, as you alluded to, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's, we did, and then I'd love to hear more commentary, but we did, the observation we had was we did provide one of the early points through loyalty of where you could center in on the customer and help clients who didn't have that information start to act on it or understand that dimension a bit more. But I think one of the points that was made earlier was just this view of, you know, this accumulation of data. And I think it was you, Gary, who said, you know, are we gathering enough? Are we looking for external sources? And the reality is, in most organizations, use the word ghetto in the book, I actually talked about data ghettos or data silos. And that, you know, one of the big challenges is for the last, the exercise for many retailers over the last little while has been really creating that data lake and sort of consolidating data that exists in different vertical, you know, functional areas in the organization, but never has had a central focus where it's all in one place and therefore can be cross-referenced to create the critical insights.
Christine, when you're at Nike, how did you factor in, say, external research in conjunction with the, what we call maybe the hard data, transactional level, or I'll go a step further, qualitative external research where you're doing focus groups? How did you, was there a repository, or how did that get shared and disseminated?
Well, that was really embedded in a lot of the DNA of the company. So there were external, but quite often most of the categories did their own internal. So, I mean, I ran focus groups. We worked with external. We did internal ones. We worked with athletes. So we really ran the gamut. We partnered with retailers to do research. But really, you know, in the brands that I worked with, consumer was at the core. So if you don't know the consumer, you don't understand what their needs are, what their pain points are, how to affect change for them, then it's hard to really build a robust, you know, strategic kind of business. And I think to Brian's point, like, yeah, definitely the analytics come in there, and that's a critical piece of it. But quite often we were doing the research, and, you know, sometimes those commentaries from a person can come out and all the research in the world might say something else, but then you hear a pain point or a conversation and it gets you thinking in more of an innovative or strategic way to say, you know, we really have a feel like these comments have come up a couple times in these different areas, and we need to start exploring that further. So definitely that was a big part of working in an organization like that. And when we didn't do that, we often found that, you know, through the politics of the company, you know, leadership is like, we need to do this, or we need to do that, or that's how it's been done before, or whatever. Then the further you kind of get away from that opportunity around the consumer and building to that, and then doing the research to say, put the product on the consumers. We did a lot of consumer-led work as well. So getting them in the product, getting them to provide feedback was another big part of that cycle. So you had all these different elements that you kind of put together to come up with your robust plan and strategy. And then, you know, hopefully from there, the feedback and the insight comes back that you've done the right thing. But definitely, I think the challenge is different people look at data differently. And we were talking about this earlier, it's just the culture of an organization and how do they accept and understand data and what does that look like and how do you embed that and all the different functionality of information that goes into it to kind of funnel it into the decision-making that might have to happen. And, you know, you start separating out if you're a global brand and you've got different regions and different areas, states, provinces, whatever. If people aren't looking at it the same way, if they're not really functioning in and understanding how those things operate and work together, can be really challenging, because then the element of trust is gone and people are looking at it saying, well, I don't trust what they're saying. They're not looking at the data the same way that we're looking at the data. And I've definitely been in situations where, like that, where you've had to kind of step back and say, okay, how are we all going to collectively view this? And then how do we move forward with that information to make the best decisions?
Could I just stay the conversation in just a slightly different way? Because we've been in retailing, we've been plagued with terms such as store of future, customer journey, you know, customer experience. We've had for a few years personalization. Now, I have no idea what that means in if there's a huge gap between what data we do, how we drive insight from that, and then how do we get right down to not just a segment, but an individual customer and deliver something that's incredibly compelling for them to shop our brand, whether or not it's on a web, on an app, come into the store, whatever. And I just find retailing obsessed with new terms with very limited, if not no, capability to respond. Omnichannel is another one, but let's stick with personalization because that's highly, highly integrated into this whole area of how do we ask ourselves questions to know what the customer is, to know what to provide to that customer, what problems they're currently experiencing, what pain points are, I think you mentioned earlier, that where does personalization sit in it? Why doesn't it flash up how inadequate some of our data systems are, data gathering systems are, and how do we actually bridge that gap and what stops us?
Yeah, you missed customization in there, Gary, but...
Oh, yeah, well, that was a sort of 70s
thing. I mean, you were on a roll. I thought you were going to nail it, but but you're right. You are right, though. I mean, and you know, I do have to say this. It's a bit of a pun, but you know, all these terms seem to be more about marketing somebody's concepts than they're actually doing anything else, right? And in a lot of these sessions that I've sat in that are on customization or customer experience, very few talk about how you use that data to actually enhance that customer experience. Because I don't think, I'm gonna be blunt, I don't think a lot of them actually have hands-on experience in doing that. So I challenge it, but you know, but Brian, I also have, on Gary's points, I have to ask you this question.
Yeah.
You mentioned data ghettos, right? What percentage of companies out there right now and they're big ones, small ones, medium size, are living in a data ghetto? Has it changed? Is it better or worse?
I think it's getting better. And so, boy, I've got so many comments here. So the first thing is, back to your comment, Gary and then George, on the personalization thing. I think there are more companies doing and utilizing strategies in that space, with one caveat, but they are loath. Our challenge of getting our clients to talk about what they were doing in public settings where they'd be sharing that, this is the key to data and marketing directly to the consumer, is it's a stealth bomber attack. okay? Your competition doesn't see what you're doing. They don't understand the dynamics of the offers. They don't understand any of that. And so it's kind of like the secret weapon that exists in those companies that are doing it really, really well. Now, how many of them are doing it really well? Okay, that's a different question. And I think that part of the challenge that exists, and it's a little like what we're experiencing with this AI company with category management, is that there is a well-established way of doing things that works, that probably provides an 80% solution. And to get the next 20%, you kind of have to take your hands off the steering wheel. It's a little like a self-driving car. Human intervention in an offer structure to create personalization is not going to work truly on a one-to-one basis at scale. It's very difficult to do it without having a willingness to take your hands off the steering wheel and let the machines do some of that work, right? And so there is a reticence amongst the market to kind of lean in and get there. And so, you know, we were in a marketing which was one to everyone, one to many. We'd love to get to one to one, and we're really living in a one to few world. Clusters, and you do what Christine has done. You put them in a room, or you research it, you figure out whether you got it right, and then you start marketing and you deal with the responses on how things are going. It's an iterative process. That's sort of the dynamic that we're dealing with. And last point I would make is, I think for me, one of the interesting things is, do we have a critical mass of people in the marketplace who really understand how to do this? And have they gone and been promoted to levels in the organization where they've got a level of gravitas to influence the organization? And on that fact, I think we're on the journey right now. We're probably 30% of the way to where we need to do it. Schools are now making courses and masters of management analytics. You know, it's seen as an area where, you know, you're not just getting the guys who can do the math and in the programming, you're starting to get people who have management discipline, who can understand how to connect the dots and then work it through. It's like the migration that happened with the CIO, where the CIO used to be very technical and understand all the pieces. And then gradually they needed to be as much strategists as they needed to understand technology, because they had to play that translation role. And I think we need to see that same thing start to happen in data. And then we'll see maybe personalization in customer journeys and all the rest of these things will have a material impact on the offer structures that go out.
Brian, we do a lot of work in this area, and I'm so glad you just said that point of the maturity of the thinking around data having to happen. And I'll just throw out a few examples. Firstly, at very senior levels, the word data is not well understood. Some people gravitate to hard numbers. It's quantitative. So they totally dismiss any opportunity for anything that's more exploratory data, even social scraping data or qualitative research or anything like that, gets very dismissed in favor of something that's quant, because in their mindset, the word data is a number. And the other thing that is often not done is the ability to articulate what the end goal is. Like, data becomes, the metaphor would be, I need to get a hammer, as opposed to I need to go and build something. There's a focus on the tools, and even more so when very good salespeople at various enterprise solutions around data management are pitching things every single day. So you think, well, I've got data covered because I've bought the software suite. You know, we got Salesforce, therefore we've got data checked off. And I kind of break data down into, if it's on the customer end, and Gary, you're going to think about product, and Christine will think about product data and all the other things. But if I'm thinking about customer, I'm thinking the personalization is really about data for execution. So the data is almost in a fast process executing for you. So that's one use of data. And you could say that's all we want to do, but express it. But the others are, Christine, you talked about what I call data for inspiration. So you're out there working with the consumers to then kind of, something will just click and you go, hey, there's an opportunity in the market, and we wouldn't have got there without that sort of exploration. And I'm going to tell you right now, the term I hated back in the day was actionable data. Because what that did was it dumbed down every single question. You wouldn't ask a question unless you already knew the answer, because otherwise, how would you know it's actionable? And then at the end of the process, you'd go, we didn't really learn anything that earth shattering. Well, you set the scene for that. And then the other one is kind of evidentiary data. So it's kind of like support, finding out a little bit more why your sales are down. Like it's the rear view. Our sales are down because our customer sat's down and this and that. But I think there has to be a discussion at a senior level, agnostic to tools, around what are we trying to do in terms of what's our vision for what we want to do with data. And if we're talking about customers, is it going to be acquisition where we need outside data? Is it competitive work? Is it the forces outside? We need to do more external. I mean, I'm going to stop now, but that level of rich discussion in the cases we've gone on the inside, really we're driving it as an outsider. That's not naturally happening. It's kind of like, let's get the data suite, the enterprise software, and someone reporting into marketing will do everything that needs to get done. And I think that's a big structural cultural barrier right now. Off the high horse officially as of this moment.
Brian, how does the culture need to change in an organization to achieve that data level of nirvana inside an organization? What needs to change in an organization to make that happen?
How much time do you have, George?
Hours, I guess, but I think we're going to be out of time.
I think David's point around, you know, the simple mindset of we'll get an analyst, toss it into marketing, they can do some analytics. You know, it's, you've got to have this as a key strategic tenet. And what's interesting is it actually starts with a very simple statement, which is, you know, I have a desire, which is to serve and to understand more and to serve that customer better over time. And then you start down the road, well, what do we really know about the customer? And how do we start to action that? How do we collect more information? And it's also a combo, I think Christine touched on earlier, of using some combination with just the data piece. You can't solely rely on data. I do believe that one of the things that can be done is to elevate the role of a data scientist or a chief data officer in an organization. I think that's an important piece to making, you know, to raising the profile of. So I think all those things are critical. In many instances, it's also just about making an effort to start to obtain data, either from your own sources or other sources. So,
Frank, can I add one to that, which is the senior level has to understand to get real value out of it. They have to open the gate to questioning processes and procedures that were long held. Like if you say we're going to use data and it's going to be this great value add return, but no one's allowed to behave differently, then your hands are tied with it. And I've seen that so many times. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a dereliction of duty. If you're not saying, yeah, we're going to allow some openness to strategically exploring with the data, not just do what you can with what you're allowed to do.
Are we just kind of almost having a rerun of the previous episode with Lali, which talks about all these different aspects of how does culture move? Because if we have a big vision and everybody's bought into it and we've reached that point of cultural ignition where the appetite for change is high, the need for change recognized within the business eye, and we get there and we move forward, all this all kind of falls into place. We have a vision, we know where data fits into it, we know where the supply chain fits into it, we know where our merchandise, it all fits together and everybody's on the same page. But right down here in this box where limited appetite, limited, you know, appreciation of the need for change, if we're stuck in the cultural intransigence box, then it's tough. It's tough for anybody to move that whole organization, especially when you're sitting in a silo or you've got a prescribed role of which your expectations are pretty damn clear. So I think it, to address the whole question about how do we move the organization to become much more customer centric, because that's it, that's the goal. Data literacy helps us to achieve that. It requires a fundamental shift in the expectations, in the thinkings, in what we value around here, or what our values are around here. And that's a real tough one.
Yeah.
Unless Christine said at Nike, they kind of had that baked into their culture. And that's a good example where it wasn't hard then to, right, Christine, you were injecting. Yeah.
Well, it's an expectation. Every group had it. And then there were different people that worked within the group who were mining insights on a consistent basis. And then if you had a particular project that you wanted to say, get more insight into cold weather running, then you'd put together sort of a strategy and a plan, and the team would go out, you'd do extensive research, you'd go global, and you'd have someone facilitating and helping on a larger project. But on a day-to-day basis, every single person in the organization really was focused on consumer insight and athlete insight and connecting and understanding better, which can be challenging in some organizations. If you're not a really direct-to-consumer brand, you don't have the ability to really understand how your consumers are shifting or moving. But, you know, back to what Brian was talking about earlier, there's so many brands that start digital first, build that community, whatever it is that they've got, and then take that to a brick and mortar. And there's so much more success around that because that's ingrained in how they operate to begin with. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think in a lot of situations, brands go at it the other way and they've kind of got their goods and whatever, and then they're driving it and saying, well, you know, this isn't working because of this, this, and this, and they're not really mining into the detail. And I think all of us as consumers know the frustration of working with a brand and going in and them not understanding what you need or how you want to navigate or what you're all about. And the brands that do well are the ones that can tell us, Amazon's a great example, what you've been purchasing. Here's examples of things that you might want to look at because of those purchases. You know, we can see a thread that you like to read certain types of novels where we're going to push you that way. So like then those things become helpful to a consumer because it's navigating and giving you ideas that you might not have had before. So I think it's getting to a place where we're using it to the advantage and then truly where the consumer feels like they're understood and that they're on a journey with you either as a brand or understanding kind of that they know a little bit about me. And then there's a great feeling of, I want to go back to that brand and purchase from that brand because they have an understanding of my preferences and what I like and can follow me a bit on my journey and maybe take me somewhere where they didn't really think I wanted to go. Just as you would go into a retail store and go in and want to buy a coat and someone convinces you to buy a sweater and you never would have thought you'd buy it, but you found your way to it.
That's my AI issue is sometimes I think it dumbs down serendipity. But back to Gary's point about culture, when you had new hires coming into Nike, into your team, was that an issue where they in their previous job might have relied on their own experience or had to just go with their gut, quote unquote, only? Was that a culture clash for a little bit, or how did you deal with that?
I don't think we really ever, from my experience at least, I was really fortunate. We definitely had people that came from the outside, but I think there was an embracing of it and an understanding of it. And I used to say to the teams that I worked with that there's a power in understanding and knowing that. So you can have a gut feeling and you can look at the data and everything else. But if a consumer is coming to you time and time again and asking for something and it's a pain point for them and you can provide a solution to them, there's so much power in that and understanding like what's going to be successful in whatever products you create, because you've listened to them and you're really adhering to an opportunity or need that maybe either wasn't out there before or is something that they had that they really felt wasn't functioning for them. So it's, I think in, you know, these companies like Adidas, Nike, Lulu, et cetera, that's ingrained in how they operate. It's this community and this understanding and knowing, you know, what runners want, what basketball players want, you know, what someone doing yoga wants. And they have a community and a culture around that. And so how do you get and tap into that, you know, and really getting and mining into the insight of doing what these people are doing, following them on their journey, where the trends are happening, being a part of the trend as it goes versus coming in later where you might not feel as authentic. So, I think I was really fortunate to work in those environments and situations because it's not like that in every company. And there's always that balance of there's the data and you've got to respect that and look at that. And we did a ton of that, but we also spent a lot of time kind of melding the two together and then sort of going from there and saying, okay, what are the opportunities to innovate and be different and move a consumer where, you know, all the data in the world could tell you one thing, but having those conversations can sometimes move you into a really cool new direction that you never would have thought of before. So,
Brian, did you see that where the leaders had to kind of learn how to use data? Like, because you worked with companies over many years. Did you see a maturity in data use on an individual basis?
Yeah, I think, and I love what Christine's saying, because I think it is this element of art and science, right? And the art part is the true marketing piece, which is, you know, getting down into the underlying motivations and drivers. Data will tell you what's happening. It won't tell you why it's happening. And so you need to get to the point that you understand the why. And I think great brands, great retail organizations have a very clear articulation of the problem they're serving and what their why is, why they're there, why the customer is having an issue or challenge why the opportunity is there to serve them with a particular product. And then, you know, circling back on some of the other conversation, I think the science part is that you can provide the measurements. Is it working? What's happening in the individual customer level? How do I prompt them along the journey? You know, those are the things that need to be integrated into the process as it goes forward. And it's the research component can play a very important confirmatory role on the math and the algorithms that are being done. So in our food retail environment, the analytics company we had there, you know, what you eat and what you put in the basket is very telling about where you are, life stage, health conditions, whatever else. And so we would do the modeling to say, you know, these conditions seem to point to consumers that have a set of solution needs. And then what we would do is we'd actually model it out, identify customers in the database, and then invite them in to have a conversation. And you'd look around the room and say, did I actually get all the people who have, you know, heart issues, heart condition issues, and therefore, or diabetes or whatever, and therefore my algorithm is actually working to identify these people. And now I can softly begin to, you know, enhance that relevance or the experience on the way through. And that is push-pull, art science, you know, whichever way you want to look at it, it's a combo pack of both. So back to your question, David, yes, there's no question there's been a migration. There's still a lot of opportunity left to continue that journey for most organizations. And last thing, you know, I'll be quiet. I did have my best ever personalization experience from Amazon. They recommended my book back to me. I thought that was awesome. So
you need to read it.
That should have been a no-brainer. Really.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
People like you are interested in this book.
I love it.
I know we're coming up on our time, but I'm gonna if we think about a maturity curve, right? Like consultants speak, but if we think about that, I still see a lot of people at the early stage, and I'll give you two kind of stereotypes. I still see a lot of leaders who are truly data phobic. Like, it's one thing if they do personalization down in the weeds of a division, but in terms of at the C-suite in the meetings, there's not a lot of use of it other than the traditional, we got to hear the sales numbers and that sort of thing, but not anything advanced. And the second tier up are people that, you know, they may not be data phobic, but they're not willing to rethink KPIs, for example. So if we're talking about customer centricity, they're still in channel metric mode and they're not kind of thinking about acquisition percentages or any other metric that might support a strategic direction that they're headed on. And those are indicators to me of where they're on the path. And the third one, I guess, would be, just add one more, is the data that they get is the data that's easiest to access. So in other words, instead of building a data program to suit the need, it's more like, well, I get this report, you know, I'm a electronics, I get a report from Sony, so I'll use that, or I'll use the Nielsen stuff. And then if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And I think, Craig, you and I have talked about that a little bit, that in Canada, there's a real dearth of public data, like industry data, compared to in the US, and therefore it harms the sophistication of use.
Both the availability of the data as well as the timeliness of it. We seem to have when you look at Stats Can, the stuff's not available nearly as you know, readily as what you get in the United States, that's for sure. And the availability of it. I mean, at least we have a census that's come back that is a bit more robust than it was under the conservative government, which really limited, I think, certain decision-making capabilities that we might have, which I think has been of a challenge. And Christine, you're talking about, you know, artificial intelligence. This is something that I've seen. I think we're going to see a few interesting innovations coming up in 2021 and 22. I've spoken to some companies that are in the artificial intelligence space. One woman has a company that she now owns, and she's telling me that one of her clients, what this product does basically is it will create product suggestions for the consumer, which is sort of that maybe personalization. She said that some of these customers had to actually stop it because they couldn't keep up with the fulfillments of orders, which is a good problem to have, I'm sure, right? But but the fact is, we're starting to see, I think, machine learning coming in and doing some of the work that humans may have had to have done before. I'm hearing, you know, reports around, oh, it's going to be smarter than humans, get ready. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if we know where artificial intelligence is going specifically, but the tech companies that I speak with, because I do some work on the side with them, it's exciting and interesting and a little bit baffling, but it seems like they're looking to at least solve problems or integrate information, which will allow for better decision-making at the retailer management level. But then on the consumer facing side, provide, you know, product suggestions, other things which could drive sales as well. I don't think it's going to replace brick and mortar retail, and I won't get into it, but I think e-commerce is not going to be what people think. I think that it's, I think a lot of the retailers we're seeing opening right now are going to be doomed, but I think, you know, artificial intelligence is really going to, I think, change things in the next while. So that's probably a whole nother conversation there.
Yeah. Data literacy point, garbage in is garbage out. So from the literacy point of view, it's great to have those, but if you don't understand your inputs and be able to understand the quality level of those.
AI is like a super duper spreadsheet. So you have, as David said, if you understand the process to the point that Christine made earlier, if you understand where the sources of information are and you know what to do with them and you can document that, and then you can put your AI on top of that, we're all good. It does it faster, more reliably than maybe a human being. But if you don't have that visibility of what your process is, you throw AI at it, the first thing it's going to, or the, you know, the technical implementer will say, well, what data have you got? What do you do with it? Oh, I'll model that. So you can do it all faster, but you're just doing the same thing just with some sophistication in it. And that's the downside with thinking that the leap, and I think they've made this point earlier, it's a leap to the tool, not leap to the process. Because I think the process is key here, and the tool should just come along to make that process more robust, more consistent, more faster, or more real time than perhaps a human doing it. But if you don't know what the process is, or if you just say, this is it, this is the best we can do, just put the AI on top of that, we'd be fine. It's just accelerating yourself into an early bath.
You know, I want to tap into the AI conversation and tie it back to data. I think AI is probably developed a little bit further than we think. You know, and the evolution of it is happening much faster. But there's a professor by the name of George Westerman from MIT, and he has a quadrant that's called the digital mastery, and there's four quadrants to it. And the X and Y are leadership and digital capabilities. And I'll get to it real quick. So you at the bottom right they're called conservatives. At the bottom left are the beginners. At the top left, they call them fashionistas, which is because they love and to experiment with a lot of technology and everything. And then you have the digital masters. The digital masters, just to point out, they use AI, they collect a lot of data, they use the information, they actually use it to deliver results. On average, these companies deliver 26% more profit than companies that are not digital masters. And they're not leveraging their data and the AI and all the technology that they've invested in. So, and to me, that's a very relevant ending for me. It's that if you're not using it, if you're not leveraging technology the way you're supposed to, you're not going to get there. And the gap is huge at this point.
Thank you so much, everyone. And thank you so much for our special guest, Brian Pearson, former CEO of Loyalty One. And we've got our regular guest, of course, here as well. We've got Gary Newbery, George Minakakis, Christine Cowan, David Ian Gray, and I'm Craig Patterson.
You have been listening to the Business of Retail podcast, an unflinching strategic alternative to the conventional industry discourse. Thank you for joining us. For more information, please go to www.thebusinessofretail.ca.